cognitively diverse team is like a group of people pulling on different sides of a rubber band. The more tension, the farther the rubber band can launch if it's pointed in the right direction. Psychologists call this cognitive friction, where cognitive diversity collides and creates potential energy. Just like a rubber band, if the tension in a group of different people gets too great, things break down. The group snaps. It makes no progress. At the other end of the spectrum, in the absence of tension, there's also no progress. A group of people standing around like a limp rubber band goes nowhere. Between these two extremes, between inertia and destruction, lies a zone of possibility. This is where the magic of group progress happens. We might call this area, where cognitive friction creates potential energy, the tension zone. But to simplify, and because tension zone sounds like a Kenny Loggins song from the 1980s, let's just refer to it as the zone. So think about our imaginary rubber band graph, and pretend that the tense part of this graph is called the zone. In American slang, being in the zone implies that a person is focused and able to perform their best at something. So it's not inappropriate for us to say that the zone, in capital letters, is where that kind of magic happens for a team. And the important ingredient, the thing that gets teams into the zone, is not peace and harmony and sameness. It's engaging the tension between their perspectives, heuristics, ideas, and differences. When we look at the history of great collaborations, we see this pattern everywhere. In fact, every successful cognitively diverse relationship takes place inside the zone. And it's the key to explaining our merger paradox. At one point, when they were working on their airplane, Orville and Wilbur Wright had a problem with the propeller. They needed something to propel the vehicle forward, which a spinning blade could, in theory, accomplish, but it was unclear how to make it work, to get the plane off the ground without sending it out of control. So as usual, the arguments began. They shouted back and forth at each other for weeks. They flip-flopped sides of the arguments and eventually realized that they were both wrong. The solution wasn't a propeller, it was two propellers, each spinning in a different direction, which is just about the perfect meta-analogy for how the zone works. I really wish you could see this graph here. It's our mountain diagram from earlier, only we have Orville Wright on one mountain peak yelling, "Yo, Wilbur, I think I have the answer." Meanwhile, Wilbur is on another peak shouting, "Nah, dog, look at this over here." Orville and Wilbur knew that neither was going to think up the design of an airplane by himself. Their arguments created tension that pushed them into the zone where progress was possible. But while arguing helped the brothers explore new intellectual territory together, it also created the danger of going too far, of devolving into real fights or hurt feelings, like a rubber band ready to snap. And this diagram's probably my favorite. Orville's saying, "I'm gonna effing murder you, Wilbur." And Wilbur saying, "I think it's time to switch sides." So to keep the tension safely within the zone, Wilbur and Orville did their little debate switcheroo. This technique helped them to decouple the arguments from their personal egos, which in turn helped them look at things from different perspectives without getting too mad. It depersonalized the conflict, ensuring that the goal was always to make progress up the mountain rather than to kill each other. "I don't think they really got mad," said a mechanic who worked with them, "but they sure got awfully hot." In his basement studio, Robert Diggs harnessed the cognitive friction between his rappers' diverse styles and personalities, and also the tension between his own diverse tastes, to create a new sound. By channeling the potential energy from the Klan's rap battles into a collective goal, Diggs was able to make the hip-hop world's most powerful rubber band gun, so to speak. He managed to keep things inside the zone long enough to make Wu-Tang superstars. Diggs' strategy of scrambling different rap styles together spilled into each individual rapper's technique. Raekwon shared his experience of street life through culinary metaphors. Method Man mingled drug references with Green Eggs and Ham and classic Dick Van Dyke songs. Inspector Deck reflected on gang violence, Greek philosophy, and science. At times, though, the conflict at Wu-Tang went too far. Over the years, the group fought and sparred and walked out on one another dozens and dozens of times. In 1997, as Chrysler and Daimler were crafting their merger plan, persistent infighting forced Wu-Tang to drop out of its massive tour with rock band Rage Against the Machine. Which reminds me, what about our poor friends at Daimler Chrysler? Their relationship wasn't nearly as volatile as Wu-Tang's. The Germans and the Americans were different, sure, but they never got in any shouting matches. It turns out their problem wasn't too much conflict at all. It was the exact opposite. Part 7. Any science writer who ends up writing about relationships eventually ends up at the Gottman Institute. I was no exception to the cliche when I started digging into the science of dream teams. At their research center in Seattle, Doctors John Gottman and Julie Schwartz Gottman study romantic partnerships and what makes them tick. I found them because of my interest in what makes lovers stop ticking. What causes partners who once thought that they'd be better together to call it quits? The answer is surprising, but quite simple. Quote, interaction patterns such as disagreement and anger exchanges, they report, may not be harmful in the long run. In fact, conflicts can be, quote, predictive of improvement in partnership satisfaction over time. The reason is not because arguing makes us happy. It's actually because if you're still arguing, you're probably still together. There's potential energy in the rubber band you're stretching together. If you keep talking long enough, and those arguments don't spill over into violence, you're going to eventually work things out. Indeed, the biggest leading indicator that a marriage is about to end is not, in fact, when couples argue. It's when they stop talking. Two experiments help us connect this to our exploration of differences in teamwork. First, a group of researchers from Harvard, Berkeley, and University of Minnesota decided that they wanted to know just how much training people to be mindful of demographic diversity helped big companies with lots of employees. So they found 829 businesses that emphasized diversity training and tracked how they fared over a period of 31 years. In 2007, they published their surprising results. That is, that so-called diversity training programs had, quote, no positive effects in the average workplace. In fact, they found, quote, in firms where training is mandatory or emphasizes the threat of lawsuits, training actually has negative effects. Emphasizing how not to offend people who were different scared employees into disengaging. Then, in a 2015 experiment, another group of professors took a group of white men who were applying for an IT job and separated them into two groups. Before the job interview, they told half of the men about the great efforts the company they were applying to used to focus on racial diversity. The other half weren't told anything about that. The job applicants who'd gotten the diversity message did worse in their job interviews. Their heart rates rose. They were more nervous. They talked less. Talking about race differences made them freeze up. And this was, according to the professors, quote, regardless of these men's political ideology, attitudes toward minority groups, beliefs about the prevalence of discrimination against whites, or beliefs about the fairness of the world. These two experiments reveal something about human nature. Our most primal reaction when we are put together with people who aren't like us is precisely the reaction of these test subjects. We tend to freeze. We get nervous about the tension we see coming, so we clam up. Even if we have good intentions toward other people. A managing director who oversaw demographic diversity at one of the world's largest banks put it well to me one night over dinner. She said, one of the biggest problems we have is we hire all these different kinds of people and then tell them to fit our way of thinking. She would soon leave her job to oversee diversity at the world's other largest bank, where the same thing would happen. They have all this potential to add to the culture, she said, and you watch them slowly learn to keep quiet. If you're different from other people in your group, it's incredibly easy and incredibly common to get nervous and stop speaking up. I tried to confirm this phenomenon myself. In 2016, I conducted a nationwide survey of employees of 100 major U.S. corporations. I asked these employees about the differences between themselves and their coworkers and managers, whether they were in the minority or majority in various categories, like race, gender, age, experience, education, and geographic background, and then asked various questions aimed at discerning how much they were able to use their different ways of thinking at work. I then cross-referenced this with data on how innovative their companies were. The upshot of the study shouldn't surprise us, given what we've been talking about. Businesses that rank high in innovation, the ones that grow quickly and produce game-changing products and services, tend to encourage the airing and clashing of diverse viewpoints. Not just having differences, but speaking up. The data were persuasive. No matter how demographically diverse, organizations that let their people use their different mental toolkits are going to be more effective at finding new peaks on Problem Mountain. Companies that don't innovate tend to make people follow a single approved way of thinking. Their different kinds of people keep quiet about their different perspectives and heuristics. They break less ground than companies that encourage everyone to speak out. And this, it turns out, was the festering sickness hidden in all those failed mergers we talked about. In 2011, a group of professors from the University of Athens decided that they wanted to see exactly how people behave after their companies go through a merger. So they found companies that were merging, met their employees, and put tracking devices on them. They then sat back and observed where the people went, whom they interacted with, and what they said to one another. Numerous studies already supported the theory that integrating cultures was the most difficult part of a merger, but this was the first time anyone had looked at how much people from different companies actually spoke to one another. The answer, it turned out, was not much. The professors observed that most mergers did not lead to an increase in fighting, but instead they led to an increase in something they called organizational silence. Basically, this is when team members don't talk about important issues or at all. Companies that had organizational silence developed a lack of social trust among their employees, and this led to mergers failing to live up to their potential. If we think back to our rubber band diagram, organizational silence basically pushes the tension to the left, reducing the potential energy and making the rubber band inert. Rather than deal with the discomfort of cognitive friction that comes with everyone's different perspectives and heuristics, the people inside of most newly merged companies get quiet. And that, it turns out, is worse for business than arguing. Organizational silence has contributed to some of the most spectacular mistakes in history. After the infamous Bay of Pigs fiasco, one of the biggest U.S. foreign policy blunders of the 20th century, several former cabinet members would later admit they regretted not speaking up. President John F. Kennedy's team stood tacitly by while a gung-ho CIA persuaded the president to secretly land troops in Cuba. In the months after the Bay of Pigs, Kennedy aide Arthur Schlesinger wrote, "I bitterly reproach myself for having kept so silent during those crucial discussions, though my feelings of guilt were tempered by the knowledge that a course of objection would have accomplished little save to gain me a name as a nuisance." Imagine that once again, you're the Chris Jung of your team, the person who thinks differently among a group of similar thinkers. How much time does it take before you start holding your tongue rather than keep bringing up ideas that create conflict for the group? Where there's difference, there's tension. And where there's tension, there's often fear. And fearful people often avoid speaking up. This is what the employees of Chrysler and Daimler did. In the beginning, the Germans were afraid of coming across as heavy-handed, so they, quote, stayed away from Detroit. Fearing conflict, Daimler-Chrysler executives were reluctant to mesh the two organizations too closely, not even the brands. Married on paper, Mercedes, Dodge, Jeep, and the rest were strangers to one another. Schremp told himself there is no point in trying to smash these two companies together, said Chrysler's former vice chairman. Chrysler's chief, Bob Eaton, seemed withdrawn. He went weeks at a time without speaking to the head of Daimler. Whereas Eaton had once been fond of preaching what he called participatory management, now he seemed like he'd stopped participating altogether. Peter Stahlkamp, one of the Chrysler executives responsible for the company's success in the 90s before the merger, told CNBC, "The managers feared for their careers, and in the absence of assurance, they assumed the worst. There were a good 18 months when we were being hollowed out from the core by the Germans' inaction and our own paralysis." Could we really have expected this to go well? Within a couple of years, two crucial Chrysler VPs had packed up and left for jobs at Ford. A heavy cloud hung over the organization. Managers weren't engaged. Employees weren't engaged. All the predicted synergy went out the window. Things began to fall apart at Daimler Chrysler. "What happened to the dynamic, can-do cowboy culture I bought?" Jürgen Schremp lamented. Most of the cowboys were still there. They just checked out of the rodeo. Part 8. If any member of the Red Army hockey dynasty can be called a secret ingredient, I'd argue that it's longtime team captain Valeri Vasiliev, and not for the reasons one might initially assume. You may recall that this was the guy who had a heart attack during a game and kept playing. Vasiliev was a hard worker, the embodiment of the cliché leaving it all on the rink. Compared to his teammates, Vasiliev could barely skate. He never scored, but his team didn't care, because when Vasiliev was around, they did better. This was due in large part to the role Vasiliev played in sparring with their coach. Coach Tikhonov, for all his rigor and discipline, was a tyrant. He would deny the players access to their families during practice season and wouldn't allow them to go to the funerals of loved ones. He would berate and pummel and abuse the players when they screwed up. And Vasiliev would fight back on their behalf, berating the coach when he made mistakes too. Fascinatingly, neither man seemed to take this stuff personally. Vasiliev would show up to practice the day after a physical fight with Tikhonov and act like nothing had happened. When Tikhonov pulled the good players and made the team lose the Miracle on Ice game in the Olympics, Vasiliev allegedly choked Tikhonov on the bus. Tikhonov knew Vasiliev would push back, do what these great captains do, says Wall Street Journal sports journalist and author Sam Walker. It was part of the process. It wasn't a personal thing, he said. It was about the team. The Red Army didn't just benefit from the cognitive friction of its coaches' diverse stylistic inputs, the dance and ninja training, the marathon skating drills. They also benefited from the constant tension between coach and captain in the name of bettering the team. Keith Yamashita, the founder of SY Partners and coach to Oprah and Steve Jobs, who we met earlier, likes to talk about how micro-actions add up. 100 small instances of being included as part of the group can lead to organizational trust, and even explain how people like Tikhonov and Vasiliev could fight like they did and still work together. They never stopped engaging each other in the name of the cause. On the other hand, 100 small occasions of being ignored or excluded, even if each occasion on its own is innocent or not a big deal, leads us to feel like outsiders, perhaps even hated. The team member who sits on the bench, doesn't get the high five, doesn't get asked for input, may as well be a ghost. This is why research by Gallup shows that when a manager ignores his or her people, the chances of those people being actively disengaged are a whopping 40%. And, as writes Gallup's Tom Rath in his book StrengthsFinder 2.0, having a manager who ignores you is even more detrimental than having a manager who primarily focuses on your weaknesses. The Red Army didn't have that problem, and neither did Wu-Tang. In terms of self-destructive potential, Wu-Tang's merger of 9 volatile personalities far outstripped Daimler Chrysler's merger of equals. And yet, despite the arguments, despite walking out on shows, despite some very public brawls over money, Wu-Tang managed to produce 7 albums together over 25 years. There was no organizational silence. They were the family that never truly fell apart because they kept coming back to hash things out. And as uncomfortable as the infighting was, Diggs recognized that it was this very friction that made them powerful. When steel rubs against steel, RZA said, it makes both blades sharper. Part 9. The 1983 movie Shaolin and Wu-Tang opens with a dojo scene. Students from 2 rival schools are tussling. One school is Shaolin, which specializes in a secret fist technique. The other is Wu-Tang, keepers of a secret sword strategy. Both teachers throw in the towel early. "Don't show him too much," the Shaolin master warns. The elders are less afraid of losing than they are of the kids giving away their secrets. Before long, the bad guy, the evil Qing Lord, learns about the school's secret techniques through his spies. Realizing that they pose a threat to his power, the Qing Lord hatches a plan to eliminate them. He holds a martial arts contest, hoping that each dojo will destroy the other. But the 2 rival kids from Act 1 get wind of what the Qing Lord is up to. They join forces. When they combine their unique heuristics, the Shaolin fist and the Wu-Tang sword, they create a deadly combination. The Qing Lord is appropriately defeated. "You're a genius to have mixed the two," the Empress tells the young warriors in the final scene. Robert Diggs didn't just mix two techniques. He mixed nine of them. And in Kung Fu tradition, each of his nine master rappers mixed various styles, foreign ideas, and non-musical metaphors into his own musical process. A decade after bringing the Wu-Tang Clan together, Diggs could finally afford to travel the 7,000 miles that lie between New York City and the real Shaolin. He could finally afford to see the real Wu-Tang Mountain. He recalled, "When we stood on this mountain and looked up at the range of peaks called the Nine Dragons, this is what we saw. Three mountains forming a giant W, the symbol I chose to represent a crew of nine men 9 years earlier. It was as plain as day, and has been for a million years, but some things aren't visible until you're truly ready to see them." Diggs' obsessions gave him a unique set of perspectives when he looked at his own mountain, the mountain he and his brothers would have to climb if they were ever going to get out of the projects. Kung Fu taught Diggs that friction sharpens our mental weapons, and that those weapons are more powerful together than alone. Spiritual mathematics had taught him that seemingly conflicting things can combine to form something wonderful. And chess taught him, like Valery Vasiliev and the Wright brothers, to depersonalize conflict in the name of getting better. "The most important thing is to realize that the problem is on the board," Diggs would reminisce. "It's not with you." As we can see, there's enormous potential energy in diverse perspectives and heuristics. But we can't unlock that energy unless we knock our heads together. Dream teams, in other words, predictably require tension. It's a compelling idea, the power of the zone. But as Diggs learned, as Daimler learned, as the Wright brothers learned, making our cognitive diversity work for us isn't easy. So often, the same tension that can lead to progress instead leads to destruction or inertia because we can't handle our differences. The problem, and as I would soon discover, also the solution, lies in a tiny cluster of cells at the center of our brains. Chapter 3. The Magic Circle. Part 1. The mood in Buenos Aires at the turn of the 20th century, for its immigrant residents at least, was tense. Nestled along the beautiful Rio de la Plata, on the southeast coast of South America, the capital of Argentina grew from 200,000 people to 1.5 million between 1870 and 1910. Most of these newcomers were not Argentinian babies. They were Italians, Germans, Hungarians, Russians, and natives of 100 other places. When it became an independent nation in the mid-1800s, Argentina had the same landmass as Europe, but one-fifth the population of London. The government wanted immigrants. Immigrants to develop the land, immigrants to build the economy and pay taxes. So in the late 1800s, officials distributed 130,000 free tickets for Europeans to cross the Atlantic and settle. Those who sailed sent back word about how great Argentina was, and the ships kept coming. Buenos Aires ballooned into a thriving, dirty metropolis. Like other immigrant-heavy cities such as New York and Sao Paulo, each wave of newcomers added to the urban friction. Immigrants proudly spoke their native languages in defiance of the local Spanish. Skirmishes between various ethnic groups erupted. And with each new group in each new place came the fear that an old group's way of life would crumble. Such was the case in Buenos Aires when the first Jewish families arrived. The Argentines weren't thrilled about non-Christians moving in. They didn't understand how Jewish people did things, or why. And the government didn't like the idea of Jewish people owning land. Jewish families had left homes and livelihoods in Eastern Europe in the hope of a better future. Inevitably, however, they found themselves pushed into the less desirable parts of Buenos Aires. By 1910, there were 68,000 Jewish people living in the city. You can sense the locals' fear in the newspaper headlines of the day. "Are we becoming a Semitic republic?" asked an article in 1898 in the Buenos Aires Herald. Quote, "The immigration of Russian Jews is now the third largest in the list, while Syrian Arabs, Turks, and Arabians are also flocking to these shores." Jewish people were effectively barred from good neighborhoods and civic participation. They were victims of hate speech and, occasionally, violence. Many locals heightened the tension by championing the myth of the true Argentino, El Gaucho. Gauchos were portrayed as macho, patriotic, horse-riding cowboys who stood for everything you had to be to fit in Argentina. The gaucho was the South American Marlboro man, born and bred on the Pampas. You weren't a real Argentino, people said, if you didn't have a little gaucho in you. No strangers to persecution, Argentinian Jews faced a wrenching choice. Either lose their identity and conform to this culture, or lose their shot at a persecution-free life. The gaucho thing just didn't work for most of them. Will we get driven out of here too? They wondered. So far in Dream Teams, we've seen that extraordinary collaborations are powered by differences, and that breakthrough progress is the product of cognitive friction. But as we talked about in the last chapter, groups often fail to reach their potential because friction tends to make people nervous. In this chapter, I want to dig into how we can reduce the fear that prevents us from getting together and doing the work we are meant to do. How do we move high potential but overly tense relationships back into the zone where magic can happen? The Wright brothers' debate and switch tactic was a great way for the two of them to keep their conflict constructive. Changing sides of their arguments prevented things from getting so personal that they might destroy each other. But this technique doesn't really apply in a situation like, say, trying to make 1920s Buenos Aires a good place to live for fearful locals and struggling immigrants. And having grown up in some of the roughest neighborhoods of New York City, the members of the Wu-Tang Clan were pretty good at facing down conflict, and thus were willing to come to RZA's battles to make records together. But the Jewish and Arab immigrants of Buenos Aires were not exactly lining up to have stirring debates about community projects with the gauchos. And so, what happened in their city is what happened in most immigrant cities. People became more or less segregated into parts of the city where they could have minimal interaction with the people not like them. Operating a city, or any size community, for that matter, takes a lot of teamwork. Economies grow when people interact. Streets stay safe and clean when everybody pitches in. Ensuring people have resources, protection, and stability isn't just the mayor's job. This kind of social cooperation is the reason humans developed collaborative abilities in the first place. If you remember, we mentioned earlier that our brain's ability to interpret body language and facial expressions, and even language itself, is all part of an evolutionary toolkit that made Homo sapiens the dominant species on the planet. Thus, puny, cooperative humans hunted woolly mammoths and giant armadillos to extinction. We figured out how to defend ourselves from predators, even kill them off. And in a world without saber-toothed tigers, humans' biggest threat soon became other groups of humans. At that point, ironically, the same survival instinct that pushed us to work together also pushed us to be jerks to people who weren't like us. Whereas we could generally trust our own tribespeople not to murder us in our sleep for a woolly mammoth's sake, we came to count on neighboring tribes to want to do just that. Our brains developed a predisposition to view people who don't look or talk or act like us as potential threats. Scientists call this in-group psychology. To speed up how fast we react to potential threats, a healthy human brain automatically tends to put people into one of two categories. The safe in-group, our tribe, or people with familiar attributes who are naturally inclined to help and trust, and the suspicious out-group, every other human being on the planet. Neuroscientists have discovered that our brains are actually hardwired for this. The culprits are called the amygdalae. They're a pair of oval-shaped lumps in the very middle of our brains, responsible for helping us identify threats, and then firing up a series of automatic responses to get our bodies ready to fight or flee when danger comes. Here's how it works. Say you're walking down the street, and a minivan swerves from its lane toward you. Your brain interprets this new, loud, fast-approaching object as a threat. So your amygdalae go on alert. They trigger a waterfall of chemical responses. Your brain creates a molecule called glutamate that makes you freeze or flinch and pay attention. It then signals a part of the brain called the hypothalamus. The hypothalamus tells your glands to start pumping out adrenaline. This raises your heart rate and blood pressure, which gets you ready to either run or fight. If you're smart, you don't fight in this particular case. Your brain is an amazing organ. In an instant, you're ready to handle the threat. This automatic fear response pays off in situations involving roaring prehistoric tribes and out-of-control minivans, but it backfires when it comes to dealing with people in the modern world. Our amygdalae start the same chain reaction when we encounter people who don't look, speak, or act like we do, even if we're not in conflict. The neurochemical sequence that goes off when we encounter something or someone foreign to us is hard to control. It creates tension with people who are different before we even have the chance to start working together. Left unchecked, our natural reaction to an out-group neighbor who moves to town is an impulse to avoid or to destroy. Thinking back to the last chapter, Daimler and Chrysler employees didn't want to fight, so they fled into organizational silence. Most of us aren't prepared to face Bob from Human Resources in deadly combat, regardless of how threatened we felt during our last performance review, so we avoid him. The science is clear. If our amygdalae are normal, then we all have this deep-rooted fear towards strangers or the unfamiliar. The Greek word for it is, get ready, xenophobia. By the way, typing the words, we all have xenophobia, is terrifying. In my journey to understand human collaboration, I had not expected to encounter scientific evidence that I was xenophobic. My initial reaction was to declare this bit of science wrong and delete the sentence. But then I realized that this very instinct proved the point. My response to a new, uncomfortable idea was to avoid it. So in the interest of not being a hypocrite, I kept the sentence. My consolation for my xenophobic brain is that yours is too. This got us pretty far, because it was useful when the world was big enough for us to actually stay away from each other. But that was before we knew that a bad Starbucks is better than a good cave. The dawn of agriculture foretold that humans were going to be living at very close quarters. At that point, the amygdalae and the in-group psychology that once helped us to survive stopped being as helpful. Not only are we now surrounded by our out-groups, but more than ever, we need them and the cognitive diversity that they bring in order to make progress. Back in turn-of-the-century Buenos Aires, citizens began to panic when all the strange new people started flooding in. On the one hand, the locals could ignore Jewish immigrants, relegating them to their own neighborhoods and leaving them out of civic matters. But what would happen if too many of them showed up? What if Jewish people decided that they wanted the Intendente's office and a townhouse in the Recoleta? That was a war waiting to happen. Another option, the locals of amygdalae surely suggested, was to oppress these immigrants. They could beat them down, deny them opportunities, maybe even kill them, as Adolf Hitler's regime would do not many years later in Europe. The best choice, of course, would be to figure out how to trust each other. This would require doing one of two things. They could override the natural amygdalae process through sheer willpower, a difficult feat, or they could figure out how to get all these foreign neighbors to become part of their in-group. Of course, in 1910, nobody was thinking about things in those terms. In the history of the world, only one nation, the United States, has taken in more immigrants than Argentina. In many ways, the gangs of New York-era tensions between immigrant groups in Manhattan were mirrored in Buenos Aires. The backlash against Jewish newcomers threatened the city's stability at first. But then something wonderful happened. While Jewish people were persecuted and murdered in Europe and relegated to segregated neighborhoods in New York, anti-Semitism in Buenos Aires plummeted. Buenos Aires became the place, outside of modern-day Israel, where Jewish people were most thoroughly accepted. Urban Argentina became renowned for its cosmopolitan culture. The porteños' fear of immigrants in general and their incidents of hate crime, targeting people for being different, dropped to among the lowest in the world. Argentines developed an identity that included immigrants on the team. How did this happen? To find out, we're going to look at three stories about computer geeks. Part 2. Our first group of computer geeks hailed from Massachusetts. It was 1999. As the dust settled on the Daimler-Chrysler merger, Carol Vallone, CEO of Universal Learning Technologies, was planning a buyout of her own. ULT was well-funded and growing fast. Its squad of computer programmers made tools for teachers to manage classes online. Meanwhile, in Vancouver, Canada, a professor at the University of British Columbia had been working on an online education company called WebCT. In 2 years, WebCT, a nonprofit, had signed up almost 3 million students. It was the classic nonprofit meets for-profit romance. WebCT had connections and customers and loved walks in the rain. ULT had business and technology chops, but was allergic to cats. Would they merge? Wouldn't they? In the end, Vallone got down on one knee. ULT bought out WebCT, and together they rode off into the digital sunset. But honeymoons don't last forever. Vallone soon noticed how oppositional the cultures of her two offices were. One was a nonprofit on Canada's West Coast, the other a for-profit on America's East Coast. They had dramatically different points of view. ULT's employees were ambitious and creative, almost to the point of impatience. They weren't thrilled when Vallone announced that they would take WebCT's name and adopt WebCT's platform. WebCT's employees, on the other hand, were academic and cautious. Vallone recalls, they felt like the blue suits were coming to Vancouver to take over the company. The conflict was obvious and immediate. Organizational silence began to set in. The biggest fear on the Canadian side, Vallone recalled, was that WebCT would now be focused on enriching its investors instead of building the industry. And the Americans feared that the Canadian's university and nonprofit ethos would resist speed and innovation. Vallone worried whether the newlywed companies could really blend cultures. They were skeptical of each other. How do we build trust? Vallone asked. The ULT-WebCT merger had all the potential for progress that diverse perspectives and heuristics bring. And it had all the potential for failure. You're under attack, warned the employees' subconscious brains. Time to run or fight. Fear threatened to sink the whole enterprise. Part 3. Computer geek story number 2 starts with a stereotype. Nothing's scarier, said AJ Harbinger, than going up and talking to a beautiful woman. I had once walked in on a full-grown bear eating all my food on a camping trip, so I begged to differ, but I kept that to myself. We were in Los Angeles, at Harbinger's 2.5-story man pad. Here his company, Art of Charm, hosted a week-long confidence boot camp for single men with social anxiety. I was working on a magazine story about it. Harbinger's statement made me cringe at first, but then I considered his audience. 8 terrified, nerdy, straight white guys sitting on couches. You'll forgive me, but I know my own people. One had a condition where his voice would squeak when he got nervous around people, which was always. Another was a shy Filipino immigrant who was petrified to talk to American women, but really wanted to get married one day. Another was a computer programmer from Colorado, who hadn't mustered the courage to ask someone on a date in years. Etc. Each man had his own slightly different story, but was ultimately there because co-ed socialization scared him. The first thing Harbinger did was bring in, get this, an actual woman. Her name was Suzanne. Our assignment was to take turns bantering with her in front of the group while Harbinger recorded it. Talking to strangers is my job, but in front of a confidence coach with a flip camera, it felt suddenly intimidated. The geeks looked on in open-mouthed wonder. My amygdala started going nuts. Each day, the boot camp served up some version of this exercise. Monday it was Suzanne. Tuesday it was giving high fives to random strangers at a bar. Wednesday and Thursday it was playing silly games with a couple of ladies from a local improvisational comedy theater. They made us pretend to be characters and act out skits with them. An axe murderer applying for a job. Bodybuilders expressing effusive gratitude to each other. Couples breaking up over ridiculous things, and so on. We formed circles and made up stories together, where each person contributed one word at a time. We took turns rolling on the floor in laughter. Harbinger called this exposure therapy. The way to overcome the fear of a social situation, he said, was to put yourself in more of those situations. Afraid of strangers? Force yourself to meet some. Afraid of women? force yourself to spend time with some. Despite the apparent absurdity of some of the exercises, Harbinger cited a scientific rationale for this, quote, therapy. It's known as mere exposure effect, and it's based on classic research by social psychologist Robert Zients, and illustrated well by the following newspaper report in 1967. A mysterious student has been attending a class at Oregon State University for the past 2 months, enveloped in a big black bag. Only his bare feet show. Each Monday, Wednesday, and Friday at 11 a.m., the black bag sits on a small table near the back of the classroom. The class is Speech 113, Basic Persuasion. Charles Goetzinger, professor of the class, knows the identity of the person inside. None of the 20 students in the class do. Goetzinger said the student's attitude changed from hostility toward the black bag to curiosity, and finally, to friendship. At first, the students in this college class were not especially nice to the strange, mute person in the black bag. But merely being exposed to it over and over led students to stop being afraid of it, even to like it. Science used this and other studies to show how humans become less scared of things the more they encounter them. At Art of Charm, repeatedly interacting with Suzanne and other strangers was like Harbinger's man in the bag. Most of the guys had spent their lives avoiding interaction with unfamiliar people. Getting them to interact with strangers over and over was not only good practice, but also psychological fear-busting. By week's end, I saw a dramatic difference in our little AV club. The geeks were walking up to strangers in bars, asking them to dance, striking up conversations on Hollywood Boulevard. I was impressed. Harbinger's therapy was working. It would be easy for us to conclude from Harbinger's geeks and the mere exposure theory that Buenos Aires got more tolerant toward Jewish people simply because they lived there. But that doesn't quite explain what happened. Otherwise, we would expect to see the same phenomenon in other immigrant-heavy cities, like Sao Paulo and New York, during the early 1900s. Each of these cities indeed had a reduction in xenophobia, as measured by surveys of its citizens' fear of immigrants taking control or committing crimes over time. But nowhere was as pronounced as Buenos Aires, nor as quickly. Mere exposure effect happens a lot quicker with college students in mysterious black bags than it does with groups of people with long-standing fear of each other's religions. It wasn't enough to erase the deep-rooted anxieties in Buenos Aires in such a short amount of time. Mere exposure wouldn't be enough to make the folks at WebCT a team before nervous employees would decide to quit. And just being around unfamiliar women wasn't enough to explain how quickly Harbinger's Art of Charm alums overcame their fear of talking to them. It turns out that Harbinger, the city of Buenos Aires, and soon Villon would tap into something even more powerful. Part 4. In 2005, a motley group came together to work on a big project. There were over 20 of them, and each was an equal member of the work group, our third coalition of computer geeks. They hailed from everywhere, Asia, Australia, Europe, and all corners of the United States, from Tennessee to California. One member was a traveling salesman. Another was a university lecturer. One was a city bus driver. Another, a commercial airline pilot. There was a Chinese graduate student, an Indian researcher, a Caucasian real estate agent. There was a grandfather, a young girl and her little brother, a bartender, a firefighter, a computer programmer, an architect, an engineer, a waiter, some high school students, a health spa worker, a veterinarian, and the stay-at-home wife of a soldier who was fighting in Iraq. What task could bring such a team together, and where on earth would they convene? It was actually not Earth. They met in Azeroth, the fantasy realm dear to the hearts of all who play the online video game World of Warcraft. The 20-some-odd collaborators formed a guild of gamers, a ragtag team that took on missions in the game together. They knew each other only by their voices. They had only vague notions of their very different lifestyles and locations and levels of income. Some might have even avoided one another on the street if they hadn't known better. But they were here to play. And besides, Serpent Shrine Cavern wasn't going to free itself from the reign of the evil Hydras the Unstable. I don't want to get into too many details. Simply put, Mandrake and Cylon Lover figured out that a warlock can basically kite the lurker below by throwing instant speed dots and then just running up and down the stairs. But Angel Navio got jumpy and aggroed the Quillfang frenzy way too soon, and the guild all thought they were cooked until Doc Snopes and Flutterby cleared the last platform pack, and then it was the Quillfangs who got cooked. So after that, they were basically just farming Quillfang mobs. Morrigrim Tidewalker was a grind, but he dropped the luminescent rod of the Naru, and Hydros was cake after that. But then Jenica 9 said her mom was making her log out or she was grounded, so after that, the raid was pretty much over. So I'll come clean. I'm actually making up some of those details, but you get the idea. The broad strokes are accurate, and Hydros is indeed totally unstable. In full disclosure, I own like 16 shares of stock in Activision Blizzard, which makes World of Warcraft. I bought those shares when I was in school and excited that StarCraft 2 was coming out. Please don't ask me how good I am at StarCraft 2. Over 100 million players around the globe have been citizens of Azeroth at one time or another. You might call it the world's 14th largest country, beating Germany, the UK, and Egypt. Yet its players come from all those places and more. Contrary to the stereotype, World of Warcraft gamers are not basement-dwelling shut-ins with bad hygiene. They're doctors and bartenders and Delta pilots and everyone, even authors of books about teamwork. Anthropologist Bonnie Nardi, a professor at the University of California, Irvine, took part in the raid on Serpent Shrine Cavern. She was conducting an ethnographic study of the culture of online games and had joined a guild to get an inside peek at the phenomenon of collaboration that happens inside the game. One of the most striking things about World of Warcraft was the way it brought together social classes, Nardi observed in her book, My Life as a Night Elf Priest. Nardi had spent her career conducting research on cultures around the world, and she'd come to expect general patterns of human behavior relating to in-groups fearing out-groups. In her travels, she'd personally confirmed psychologists' observations that humans' default mode was to collaborate with similar people and avoid or suspect different people. Quote, "When I was walking around villages in Papua New Guinea or Western Samoa," she said, for example, "I was obviously an outsider whose identity required explanation." But Warcraft was different. In the game, there was neither fear nor judgment for who she was. "In Warcraft," she said, "I was just another player." World of Warcraft was a community where nobody needed to be afraid of who they were dealing with. It was a magic circle where players experienced, as Dutch historian Johan Huizinga put it, a stepping out of real life into a temporary sphere of activity, which takes the pressure of everyday anxieties away. First published in 1938, Huizinga's oft-cited Homo Ludens broke ground in explaining what happens to our brains when we play, whether it's Warcraft or another game, or it's simply joking around. Play, according to Huizinga, and later behavior scientists, is an absorbing experience where we escape from our regular social or physical obligations and experience pleasure. It becomes a refuge from real-world problems, danger, and fear. And in recent years, neuroscientists have demonstrated that play and laughter can actually change our brains to be less fearful. How? By tickling rats, of course. In my entire life, I never dreamed I'd hear the words rat and tickle in the same sentence. But there I was, on the phone with Jeffrey Bergdorf of Northwestern University. Bergdorf was the world's foremost expert on rat tickling. I can make this assertion because I believe he was, at the time, the world's only expert on rat tickling. He and his fellow researchers conducted experiments wherein they tickled rats to make them laugh. My first question for Bergdorf was probably yours too. Why? "Because these weren't just any old rats," Bergdorf explained. "These rats are depressed." Of course. Depression, in the technical sense, is when one psychologically gives up, Bergdorf explained. When you're depressed, you have a hard time engaging with the world, getting out of bed, working up the will to try. You can't see the open door to a potentially better future in front of you, and you shut down in a sort of fear-like apathy. But getting rats to laugh, Bergdorf discovered, releases a chemical in the brain that produces a rapid and robust antidepressant response. Laughing and playing can help to temporarily revitalize a rat who has stopped trying. In doing so, the rat becomes less paralyzed by the fear of the empty future its brain foresees. And after doing this a lot, it turns out, the neuroplasticity of the brain forms new pathways that helps the rat move forward. Let me be clear. Chronic depression is an insidious affliction. Millions of humans struggle with it every day, and laughter alone won't alleviate it for more than a moment. But Bergdorf's research is fascinating because it indicates how playing can physically help the brain to get braver. In other words, it hints at the brain science behind Huizinga's findings about how laughter and play can help our brains to, quote, end attention. Do you see where we're going here? When our brain perceives something scary, it goes on alert. The amygdala fire up. This could be a dangerous object, like that runaway minivan we talked about. Or it could be the presence of a person who's different than us. But when that violation turns out to be benign, the sudden realization has a cathartic effect. And so we breathe a sigh of relief, we laugh, and we go on. Happening suddenly upon a bear, for instance, is scary. I learned this the hard way. But finding out that it isn't a bear, it's just your friend Brian with his shirt off, that's a benign violation, and it makes you laugh. The amygdala stand down. The hypothalamus holds off on the adrenaline. Everything's going to be okay. This is exactly what playing does to us. As play theorist Dr. Brian Sutton Smith says, what we have in play is a simulation of an anxiety attack. Our amygdala may start to get us riled up and alert, quote, but adrenaline is not being pumped into the system, Sutton Smith says. The frontal lobes win out over the reflexive phenomena in the back of the brain. Play allows us, in other words, to become less afraid of things that might otherwise make us anxious. And that includes people from our out-group. A New York University professor named J. Van Babel demonstrated this effect in a study wherein he showed photos of black people's faces and photos of white people's faces to a group of test subjects. Van Babel scanned the test subjects' brains as they looked at the different faces. Predictably, the white test subjects' amygdala were more active when they saw black people's faces, and vice versa. Neuroscience commonly finds this phenomenon with anyone who encounters someone of another race. But then something interesting happened. The test subjects were told they would be playing a game with the very people they were seeing in the photos. When test subjects looked at the faces of fellow players, their amygdala were more calm, regardless of what they looked like. This happens in nature all the time, it turns out. Scientists have found that lemurs will play with lemurs from other kinship groups. By the way, a group of lemurs is called a conspiracy of lemurs. You've heard it, you can't unhear it. The lemurs will play to get over xenophobia. Gorillas will play tag like human children to depressurize tense situations. And that's what the millions of people who play World of Warcraft do. A surprisingly large contingent of real-life military personnel play World of Warcraft, Nardi reports. And not because soldiers love war games. They play, she said, to cope with the tension of actual war. The game is escape, remarked a U.S. Army soldier during one of Nardi's Azerothian campaigns. He said it helped to settle his fear. Escape from outside tension isn't the only benefit of play. A 2008 study published in the Harvard Business Review confirmed what we've just discovered. It found that playing online games like Warcraft helps people to become better collaborators across social divides. And not only that, the game also, quote, gradually makes them less averse to group conflict. Playing, it turns out, makes us less afraid of cognitive friction. Harbinger and his coaches at Art of Charm thought they were helping their students overcome social fears through mere exposure. But the most powerful element of the program was play. The role play in front of the camera with Suzanne was frightening, yes, but it was essentially a game. That made it easier to do. Gathering high fives at the bar? That was a game too. The improv comedy was non-stop play. Recast as play, threatening social interactions become social practice, like baby lions practicing how to hunt by play wrestling with each other. Playing helped depressurize situations that, for the students, were normally too scary to engage with. It helped them become comfortable with the inherent tension of social interactions that once drove them to shyness. Just like it would help Carol Vallone's newlywed company stave off organizational silence. Part 5. An old proverb says, you can learn more about someone in an hour of play than in a year of talk. Carol Vallone didn't have a year to spare. Her rival camps of programmers and educators were already digging trenches, preparing for segregation or war. She knew she had to do something. So, at the new company's first conference in Vancouver, she strode onto the stage for her speech wearing pancake makeup, a feather boa, 6-inch stilettos, and a 2-tone bouffant. She addressed her new company and its users as Cruella de Vil, the Disney villain, and facetiously announced that she was coming to ruin the old company. It was a hilarious acknowledgement of the worry on everyone's mind. That, she said, broke the ice. Broke the ice, broke the silence. With this little role play, Vallone rendered a tense situation more benign. Her spoof made it easier for her employees to talk openly about what they'd been saying under their breath. And Cruella de Vil was just the debut. Vallone set about creating a workplace permeated with play. She cross-relocated employees from one office to the other and restructured the company into rotating, cross-functional teams that not only had to work on projects together and make use of the cognitive diversity that she cast on each team, but also were to play together in a never-ending series of team games and competitions. Teams competed to come up with funny internal code names for new products and features the company built. They made Olympic-style bids on what the theme of each company party would be. They prank decorated the offices of employees who were out sick. They performed at all their conferences in costumed skits. They nominated each other for funny awards. When someone was caught doing an excellent job at something, her co-workers would tape a silly certificate to a barrel of pretzels and give a speech. Some of the fun was more practical, but fun nonetheless. There was a running competition that if your team could show that you could do something in a more cost-effective and collegial way, then you could have at it, Vallone said. One team figured out that instead of renting a block of hotel rooms for a company trip, they could rent a mansion for cheaper. So they did. The new WebCT was a haven for jokes and costumes, fun rituals, and made-up holidays. Contrast this with the scared silence of Daimler Chrysler's newly merged cultures. Playing created a magic circle where WebCT employees could fearlessly address the various elephants in their rooms. Play helped them feel like they were in the same in-group. It was part of the fabric of the organization, Vallone said. It diffuses angst. It diffuses fear. It diffuses worry. When we step inside the magic circle of play, we leave real-world tension behind. And play, it turns out, doesn't just temporarily alleviate fear. Over time, it helps groups conquer it. As PISA Group researchers Daniela Antonacci, Ivan Norcia, and Elisabetta Palagi point out, play, quote, leads to the direct inhibition and regulation of aggression, thus improving social integration. When we step out of the magic circle and return to real life, the players we've played with tend to stay in the safe category to our amygdala. When we head to the locker room or log off the video game or wind up the improv session, we do so as members of the same in-group. Which is exactly what happened in Buenos Aires when the Jewish immigrants started playing soccer. Part 6. During its first few decades in Argentina, football was a sport for the elite. Wealthy landowners played on manicured private football pitches. But they weren't playing football in the barrio, not at first anyway. By 1920, the city's population was pushing 2 million. Half of all porteños were born in other countries. Half of the rest were the children of immigrants. The Western Europeans soon formed a distinct bloc: Italians, Germans, French, Spaniards, Britons, and even Scandinavians. These, sufficiently similar in appearance and religion, became an ambitious political minority. Argentina's ruling class worried about the country's national identity, What was an Argentino anymore? As Buenos Aires grew, it was getting harder to answer that question with Gaucho. Around this time, football